You are listening to National Security Law Today.
Welcome to National Security Law Today, the podcast of the ABA's Standing Committee on Law and National Security. I'm Elisa Poteet. We're glad you're here. Now, on August 16th of 2024, the Congressional Research Service issued something called a legal sidebar. This one was entitled, District Court Holds That Google Unlawfully Monopolizes Online Search, Overview and Potential Remedies. Now, why would members of Congress need to task the CRS to study Google's monopoly just days after District Judge Amit Mehta issued a 200-plus page ruling saying it was a monopoly? Did you ever wonder why, after 41 congressional hearings on internet privacy, we don't have a comprehensive privacy law from Congress? And did you ever wonder why you see ads on billboards at bus stations and train stations accusing Qatar of supporting terrorists, but none accusing the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia, where most of the 9/11 attackers were from? Have you ever driven through the Kalorama neighborhood in Washington, D.C. and wondered, who owns those terribly expensive houses when Washington's a government town? Well, I have too. And the answer, to a degree, is lobbyists and the practice of lobbying, which is as old as prostitution, I mean, mankind. Nothing has described the history and greed that drives Washington influence peddling better than a new book by Brody and Luke Mullins. They're brothers. And the book is called The Wolves of K Street, The Secret History of How Big Money Took Over Big Government. So if you haven't read this already, I feel sorry for you, but it makes Succession look super boring. And moreover, it's true. So author Brody Mullins joins us tonight from inside the Beltway, where he and his brother are serving honorably in the Fourth Estate. Brody, thank you so much. What a feat. Wow. Well,
thank you so much for having us. It's an amazing topic.
It is, and a frightening topic, but I honestly think you've done a tremendous public service here, because I don't think the American public has any idea what goes on here. And I think once they know in a more detailed way, they might be pretty shocked and determined to do something about it. But let's talk about the history, because this is sort of morphed as the Washington feature or bug. How did lobbying sort of begin in modern Washington?
One of the things that I found amazing when I was researching for this book, so I've been a reporter for 25, 30 years in Washington covering lobbying and corporations and how companies try to get what they want in Washington for most of my life. And I thought I knew a lot about lobbying, and I really found out that I knew much less than I thought when I started doing research, because what we found is that lobbying has actually gone back to the earliest days of the founding of the country. And in fact, the founding fathers foresaw a day when there would be lobbying in government. There wasn't yet a Washington, actually, but they knew there'd be lobbying in government. What they thought is that there would be a group of workers who would create sort of a faction or interest group among workers, representing workers in the government. And then there'd be sort of the owners or the companies or industries would have their own faction. And those two factions would be of equal sizes and power. And they'd sort of battle each other out to create sort of an equilibrium in legislation that came out of the government. And for many years, that was actually right. The founding fathers called them factions. We now call them interest groups or lobbying groups. But for most of the last 200 years, companies and workers have sort of battled fairly and kind of on the same playing field. What changed is in the 1970s, companies started really investing in Washington for the first time. And from the 1970s to now, companies, the corporate lobbies, really dominate Washington. And conversely, the consumer groups and labor unions have very little influence in Washington. And that's really tipped the scales here, where companies have all the influence over public policy and are passing laws and legislation that helps industry, and the rest of us, consumer groups or labor unions or regular Americans, have very little say in Washington.
What would you say? I mean, based on sort of your research and handling this for 20 plus years, you must have a sense of the proportions. I mean, what are we talking about? Is it like 20% to 80% in terms of what I would call normal human groups?
It's more like 1,000 to 1. The rest of us don't even get a full percent, to a fraction of a percent. I mean, here's an example we used in our story. We talked to a professor who had done a study, his own study of lobbying a few years ago, and he interviewed 70, 80 top corporate lobbyists in Washington. And he did sort of an anonymous survey. And one of his questions was, when you corporate lobbyists go out and fight your fight on behalf of companies and industries, who is your number one adversary? Who are you fighting against? And not one of these 70 or 80 lobbyists said that they were up against a labor union. I mean, labor unions just don't have nearly the influence in Washington they used to have. And when companies are out there lobbying Washington, they're not lobbying against consumer groups or environmental groups. They're really lobbying against other companies. You know, company A is trying to get legislation passed to screw over company B, and company B is trying to block legislation that would help company C. Consumer groups and the Ralph Naders of the world just don't have the influence that they used to have.
So let's talk about what it looked like, though, when it started. I mean, in reading your book, one of the things is people must look back at that as sort of those were the salad days, light and airy. You know, I'm feeling sort of wistful. We want to describe what it looked like kind of in the beginning, or at least in the beginning modernly.
Yeah. You mean like the 1970s or before then? I guess I guess start in the 1920s or 30s and do this kind of quickly. So in the early part of the last century, there were some lobbyists. I don't think they were called lobbyists back then, but there were sort of some power brokers, some influence peddlers, but there's really only one or two or a handful of lobbyists. And those are people who knew the president or knew the Speaker of the House or knew the Senate Majority Leader. Just to step back, you know, before the 1970s, the government in Washington was far different. Power was concentrated in the White House, in the presidency, in the Speaker of the House, and the Senate Majority Leader. And those three guys, and there were always guys, you know, got together and made laws and legislation. And the rest of Congress really didn't have that much influence. And therefore, there's only a few people who knew those three. And those people sometimes became lobbyists. We write about Tommy the Corcoran, who had worked for FDR and had some relations on Capitol Hill. You know, he represented dozens of companies, made millions of dollars, and only through his relationships with a small number of powerful politicians in Washington. In 1974, you know, Watergate changed everything. After Watergate, the American people elected, I think, 70 reformers to Capitol Hill who passed laws and legislation to move power from the White House to Congress and move power from the congressional leaders into committees and subcommittees, really sort of democratizing Congress or making power more diffuse in Washington. At that point, two things happened. One is you had all sorts of members of Congress who were committee or subcommittee chairs or ranking members. So power was spread all around Capitol Hill. And two, from the New Deal to the Great Society, the size of the government kept growing and growing, and we kept creating new agencies and new departments and new divisions that had power over government. So all of a sudden, a Tommy the Corcoran couldn't just snap his fingers, make a call to the White House and get something done. Lobbyists had to know lots of people. And that sort of coincided with the growth of the lobbying industry. So the first lobbyist who we write about in our book, Tommy Boggs, we consider him the sort of one of the first modern lobbyists. When he registered as a lobbyist, he said there was about 50 or 60 lobbyists in Washington at the time in the early 1970s. You know, today, there's 13,000. And the real inflection point was Watergate, when power was moved to different members of Congress and lobbying groups and companies and corporations needed to have lots of lobbyists who could get access to all sorts of committees and subcommittees.
And so that explains, I think, why there are a lot of former staffers or political insiders that move into the lobbying business. Again, in Washington, it's not always what you know, it's who you know. And so that makes a lot of sense if you consider the fact that it's all about access, quite frankly.
Yeah, you know, one of the things we write about in our book is how companies came to power. We also write about how lobbying has changed. And you mentioned access. Access for much of the history of lobbying was the key to lobbying. It's becoming less so now. We can talk about that later. But yes, you're exactly right. Companies want access to members of Congress. And therefore, when a chief of staff to a member of Congress decides to retire or leave or needs to make more money or buys a house and needs to pay the mortgage, companies try to snap up those people in order to get access to the offices where they once worked.
Yeah, I mean, is Boehner now, he's a big advocate for the cannabis industry, right?
He is, but he's also a big lobbyist at Patton Boggs, which, the first lobbyist I mentioned, Tommy Boggs, was the founder of that firm, Patton Boggs, which is now where John Boehner works.
Incredible. So you've got almost a market demand from the fact that now power is more diffuse as a result of sort of whiplash after the abuses of Watergate. I mean, you cite these incredible statistics in your book. There was a single year, paradigmatically, the world shifted. I mean, maybe some people are reading like Jonathan Haidt's book and so on, but paradigmatically, the world shifted. Internet became a significant force. But in a single year, you write 3,200 registered lobbyists did not re-register?
Yeah. So,
what prompted that? That's an amazing figure.
Yeah, that's a great question. And it leads to one of the sort of core faults or problems that we sort of identified here in the book, which is how lobbyists register or disclose their activities. So, there's really only one law that governs lobbying in Washington. Lobbying is constitutionally protected under the First Amendment as free speech. Americans' companies, CEOs are allowed under the Constitution, under the First Amendment, to petition their government. So it's perfectly legal. The only rule we have is that if you are a lobbyist, you have to disclose, as in you have to fill out a form once a quarter saying, hey, I'm a lobbyist. Here's the companies I represent. Here's how much money I make. And, you know, here are generally the issues that I'm lobbying on. That's all you have to do. However, you know, the devil is in the details, and the definition of what is considered a lobbyist under the law is an individual who spends 20% or more of their time actually engaging and talking to public policy officials, talking to members of Congress, talking to their staff to advocate for or against public policy. So what has happened many times is when government officials, when the government or the president oftentimes enacts a well-intentioned reform of the lobbying industry, it pushes more and more lobbyists underground. And that's what happened in 2007 with what you're talking about, that before 2007, we had the lobbyist Jack Abramoff, who got in a big scandal in D.C. that took down Tom DeLay and several other powerful Republican members of Congress. After that scandal, Nancy Pelosi and Democrats took power and passed a lobbying reform bill that basically created new rules and regulations on lobbyists, among other things, saying that lobbyists can't buy anything of value for a member of Congress, can't take them golfing, can't buy a steak dinner, can't even get them a cup of coffee. As a result of that, lots of lobbyists said, hey, I know a way around this rule. I'll just stop being a lobbyist. So 3,000 people just simply said, you know what? I spend less than 20% of my time actually lobbying, so I'm not going to register. And therefore, all these rules and regulations won't apply to me. So that's sort of a sad example, but we have a long history in Washington of every time there's a well-intentioned reform, lobbyists find a way around it. And that's a pretty good example. And to make a step further here, I think in 2007, that stat that you cited, I think there was something like 13,000 registered lobbyists at the time. Two points here. One, you know, there's millions and millions of people who live in Washington, D.C., and almost every one of them is involved somehow in trying to shape legislation or public policy or push back against it or advocate for it. And the fact that only 13,000 people in 2007, you know, said they were lobbying, you know, on behalf of interest before the government, you know, is crazy. What's crazier is that in the almost 20 years since then, as the lobbying and influence industry has grown bigger and bigger and bigger, we still only have 13,000 registered lobbyists because these lobbyists know that you don't need to register. I think that number is actually a little bit wrong. I think we've gone from 12,000 to 13,000. There's been about 1,000 increase in the number of lobbyists, but that's over 20 years. So it really just shows that the metric we're using here and the definition of lobbying is flawed.
So it's like internet darknet. You see a little bit on the surface, but underneath where you can't see it, there really are thousands, maybe even tens of thousands of people that are trying to influence decisions that affect the average American's life.
Well, let me give you a great example. Because so much of lobbying is taking place in the shadows and is not being disclosed, you know, we obviously don't have numbers or data. But one of the other lobbyists we wrote about in our book, a guy named Evan Morris, he worked for a big pharmaceutical company. I got a hold of some internal figures, you know, not disclosed to the public for the company. And when Evan Morris was a big time fat cat lobbyist in D.C., he had a $50 million advocacy budget. Of that, only $5 million went to these registered and disclosed lobbyists, and $45 million was in the shadows. So I don't know if that ratio is the same for everyone else, but you know, if it is, you know, that's a 10-to-1 spread, as in we're looking at the 10% tip of the iceberg, and there's another huge amount of influence spending going on beneath the surface that no one knows about.
And nobody receiving, there's just no way that something like a nurses association lobby can compete with that kind of expenditure. And part of that, I guess, in my opinion, I'd be interested to get your reaction to this, is it costs a ridiculous amount of money to run for office in this country. And I feel like politicians are unable to fully serve their constituents because they have to spend so much time raising money. And I think it makes them vulnerable to the influence of these big cat spenders. And you offer some really incredible, at least one illustration just blew me away. And I wonder if I could entice you to talk about it, but it had to do with a company that was producing a drug that they claimed could treat, I guess, untreatable breast cancer. You want to talk about that? I don't want to give away the story, but I mean, this was stunning to me. Stunning.
Yeah, so we spent a lot of time. So back to the beginning, you know, the book is about how companies have risen to power in DC, and it's also about how lobbying has changed. So this is in the category of how lobbying has changed. So what we wrote about is back to this guy, Evan Morris, and his company, Genentech, which is a big time biotech company. they had a drug that treated all sorts of different types of cancer. They're trying to get the FDA to approve it to treat breast cancer. They had gotten a temporary approval of it, and then the FDA decided they were going to reverse course. They didn't think that the benefits of the drug outweighed the potential health concerns about it, and they wanted to pull the drug from the market. That drug for breast cancer was generating for the company around $1 billion a year. So the company obviously wanted to keep it on the market. So they launched a lobbying effort through their lobbyist in DC named Evan Morris to block or slow down the FDA. Now, the way I think most people think of lobbyists or lobbying or influence campaigns in DC is that you hire a bunch of lobbyists and send them to Capitol Hill, or you send them, in this case, to the FDA, you know, try to urge the FDA commissioners and scientists to, you know, keep the drug on the market. Instead, what they did was they went out into the country and they found, you know, hundreds and thousands of breast cancer patients, doctors, nurses who had thought this drug was actually successful, and had those people contact the FDA, you know, with their personal stories about how this drug they thought had saved their lives. And they really
and the drug cost. I mean, go ahead and mention that, because that's part of the story. Is
the cost of the drug was, I think, $70,000. I forget the exact number now, per treatment. You know, so it's a huge amount of money that the company was making from the drug. The point here is that this personal lobbying campaign, one, you know, was engineered by the company, you know, was successful in getting the FDA to delay its decision by a year. That year-long delay saved the company about $1 billion, or allowed the company to sell another $1 billion worth of this drug. A drug that, you know, by the way, the FDA says there's no scientific proof does anything beneficial. So these people—
Right, like zero proven efficacy at all.
Yeah, you're right. So it could have just not helped people. And so for one, but two, because we're writing about lobbying and not, you know, scientific data, in terms of lobbying, this huge campaign that saved the company $1 billion was not disclosed under the lobbying laws at all, because it was taking place outside of Washington, you know, not using regular lobbyists. So it was a huge win for the company. We sort of use this example as a way of showing how modern lobbying works, where instead of hiring lobbyists and going to Capitol Hill and asking for favors, companies are increasingly getting regular Americans and rallying them to pressure policymakers in DC to get what the company wants at the end of the day.
Now, I see these ads on TV sometimes, and I don't even watch linear TV, but it'll be somebody talking about how a particular part of the government is taking away something that they need. It often features somebody who's had an illness or is ill, sort of sobbing before the camera with a loving spouse, trying to understand why it is they're being denied a particular drug. I mean, that's not going door to door, but running that ad is intended to influence voters and members of Congress accordingly. So is that something that happened in this case too?
In this case, they did not run ads like that, but you're exactly right. I mean, this is what's going on. Those ads that you see, that we see in Washington, around the country, you know, they're all funded by the drug industry, and they make it seem like these are patients, or they want to find a good character, a good sympathetic figure to make their pitch. But, you know, you are watching a lobbying campaign. You know, you're not watching a commercial by some poor person who's trying to get access to a drug. You're watching a big time drug company trying to persuade the public that Congress or the FDA should approve their drug or their reimbursement, or, you know, whatever they're trying to do.
Yeah. And nobody's going into Congress and engaging directly with members of Congress who's getting paid.
They are somewhat, but most of what lobbying is doing is now moving to the states and to the public. And the idea here is back to the idea of campaigns, which you mentioned a little bit earlier. You know, a member of Congress exists to get reelected. And in order to get reelected, you need 51% of your constituents to support you. So members of Congress are very sensitive to the views and opinions of their constituents. So the pharmaceutical industry can hire lobbyists to go to a member of Congress and say, hey, you know, vote to keep our drug on the market. Or they can run ads out in the country. And if a member of Congress sees that 55% or 60% of their constituents are buying these ads and agreeing with the company, then the member of Congress is going to follow.
So it's an indirect effort to sort of motivate others to act in their stead. They never have to get off at South Capitol or park their car up on the hill.
And all that, we should say, all that is not disclosed at all. So every dollar spent on those ads, which are indirectly trying to get to the member of Congress, is part of lobbying, but is not considered lobbying under the lobbying rules. So therefore, no one knows who funded it. No one knows what company is behind it. You know, we can make some pretty good guesses, but all that part of lobbying is not disclosed. And the point, again, is lobbying is completely legal. It's completely protected by the First Amendment. All we say is disclose.
One of the things that I think is terrific about the book and sort of needs to be understood widely is this is not something that afflicts one party or another. And I thought you did a masterful job at showing how this is sort of metastasized everywhere into politics. Are these guys, and they are mostly guys, or they were certainly until very recently, are they actually partisan or just guns for hire? Can you talk about that?
Yeah. So, you know, one of the things that always struck me as someone who's covered lobbying and knows how lobbying works in Washington is that, you know, when I would go and visit relatives or friends around the country, if the people I'm talking to are Republicans, they blame Democrats for messing up Washington. If you're talking to Democrats, they blame Republicans. And, you know, it's really both sides. And it really is corporate America and a lot of the lobbying that they do in D.C. that is twisting the playing field for companies and against the little guy. And it is not partisan. It doesn't matter if it's Republicans or Democrats. What companies want is to be in bed with and friends with and influential with and have access to whichever party is in Congress. They don't care if a Republican or they care a little bit who if it's a Republican or Democrat. But in general, they want to have friends in the White House and friends in Congress. So one of the stats that we found that was so fascinating to me is that we looked at corporate PAC contributions, as in donations from companies and their political action committees to members of Congress. And we sorted that by Republican or Democrat. And we saw that when Republicans were in control of Congress, when they held a majority in Congress and set the agenda, corporate PACs in total gave about 60% of their money to Republicans and about 40% to Democrats. But when Democrats are in charge of Congress, companies just switch and they give 60% of their money to Democrats and 40% to Republicans. And that really shows that it's not partisan. They just want to be with the party in power, whoever that party is. And that sort of shows sort of how they operate. And it also leads to my conclusion that no matter which party is in power, you know, corporate America is winning.
One of the things that you talked about, I think, would be of significant relevance to a lawyer audience. And the reason I say that is that we are governed by strict conflict of interest rules. We're really not allowed to double deal. And when lawyers do, they tend to get in trouble. Is there any rule other than sort of a moral coda? Is there anything that requires any individual lobbyist, assuming arguendo, you have two big tech competitors, and I think you even have some examples in the book of this. One needs to gain a market advantage over the other one. You know, maybe they're staring down the barrel of an earnings call, whatever it is that may be suddenly pushing them. There's some sort of legislation of concern, maybe privacy legislation. Is a lobbyist bound to take one or the other in competing business interest or not?
They don't. Lobbyists can be lawyers, but they are lobbyists. And unless the lobbyists are working for law firms that have those rules inside the firm, there really are no rules. There's no set conflict of interest rules. There are no rules on who you can represent or can't represent. Now, sometimes companies say, hey, if you represent me, hey, I'm Google. If you represent me, you can't represent Microsoft. Or if you represent the airlines, you can't represent passenger trains or something like that. But there's no set rules at all. In fact, if you work at a law firm or if you're a lawyer, you know, you're not allowed to buy or sell a stock in your clients. If you're a lobbyist, you can do whatever you want.
All terribly bad. Very bad. So, you know, you wrote an amazing book. And part of it is the stories of these characters are incredible. If we hadn't seen some of them with our own eyes, we wouldn't believe they existed. But you talk about a couple that would appear to have come from different political origins. Let's talk about two of them that ended up peddling for foreign governments, because I think really that is one of the things in your book that registers alarm with people who work in national security is, you know, we really don't want foreign governments making decisions or influencing our members of Congress, period. We don't want them putting out messages without disclosure that they're foreign registered agents. And I think even an American who is, you know, not that well educated in the ways of Washington would want clear information about the origin of funds or messages. But you talk about two. You talk about Paul Manafort and Tony Podesta. Can you talk for a second about the wealth that these men accumulated doing work in these like bacchanals, they're not parties, where they would use these environments to influence others and gain a reputation for access and the ability to achieve results?
Yeah. So, you know, we write a lot about the personal wealth of the lobbyists who we put in our book. They all made millions of dollars and they all spent millions of dollars. And they all had huge egos and they wanted to be known as the sort of top players in the DC social networks. Tony Podesta and Paul Manafort are two of the people we write about. What's interesting about Podesta and Manafort is they were both, before they started becoming foreign lobbyists, they were at the top of their game. They were incredibly successful lobbyists working for some of the biggest companies in America, each making, you know, well over $1 million a year and having, in fact, I don't think I could count right now for you the number of houses that those two combined owned, but they have plenty of money. But what happened is that they were hanging out more and more with people who were making more money than them. And they were talking to foreign leaders and going to parties at embassies and whatnot. And they sort of realized that if you start working for a company in the US, you can make a lot of money. But if you work for foreign countries, you can add a zero to that. And both Podesta and Manafort had the same sort of flaw, personality flaw that drew them to that. Even though they're making $5, $10 million a year in the US, if they went overseas, they could make $50 million or $25 million a year. And they were both drawn to that. And they both ended up going down in flames as a result.
Yeah, you're resisting saying it. I mean, Podesta, for example, he had a house in the south of France, an apartment in Venice, flats in New York. He had an amazing house here, which I think Rob Report said he sold for $8.2 million. And that was after an ugly divorce. That's really incredible. I don't remember what all Manafort had, but it was...
Manafort had a $10 million house in the Hamptons and a brownstone in New York and a horse stable in Florida and something else in Virginia. That's all not counting the actual house he lived in. So yeah, these guys were, they were definitely living large. But the point is that, you know, they're living large. They would have been fine. Had either one of these people been comfortable just representing US companies, they would still be making tons of money and be fine. But both were drawn to the amount of money that you could make representing foreign leaders and dictators. And again, that's what caused them to get in trouble.
The views expressed on National Security Law Today have not been approved by the House of Delegates or the Board of Governors of the American Bar Association, and this recording should not be construed as representing ABA policy.